Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jane Franklin, author of Cuba and the United States, A Chronological History, who talks about the recent arrest of suspected terrorist Luis Posada Carriles near Miami. Bruce Gagnon, coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space, who assesses the U.S. Air Force drive to develop and deploy weapons in outer space. And Sonali Kolhatkar, co-director of the group Afghan Women's Mission, who takes a look at the current status of women in Afghanistan. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
2 months ago, the mayor of Aguadas, Colombia, Oscar Trujillo, fled for his life after receiving a threat from the head of the right-wing paramilitary group, the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, or AUC. According to The Economist magazine, the clout of the militia has grown since Colombia's president, Alvaro Uribe, engaged in peace talks with the AUC in 2003. With early backing from landowners, the AUC now operates openly in a third of Colombia's cities and towns and is alleged to be bankrolled by drug traffickers. One of the paramilitary's former commanders, Salvatore Moncusco, says the group has the support of more than 30% of the Colombian Congress. Its influence is strongest along the Caribbean coast and in coffee-growing regions, where the paramilitary has picked the candidates for mayor and governor and chooses who gets local government contracts. For many, the current peace process with the paramilitary forces mirrors talks in the late 1990s with the leftist Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. Those talks collapsed and led to the rise of Uribe, who continues to wage a bitter war on the FARC. Human rights activists worry that the AUC can now win political influence without having to renounce violence or being held accountable for past atrocities. The Los Angeles Times reports that the U.S. Justice Department is dragging its feet over the investigation into the treatment of immigrants detained in the weeks after the September 11, 2001 terror attack. Over a year ago, a Justice Department Inspector General, Glenn Fine, identified a series of problems at the Federal Detention Center in Brooklyn, New York, claiming that federal prison officials had held detainees for too long and prevented access to family members and lawyers of those held. The report found evidence of physical and verbal abuse of detainees. Key evidence, such as prison videotapes, had been destroyed. U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, when questioned by the L.A. Times, did not appear to be aware of the details of the probe. Meanwhile, a series of lawsuits filed by civil rights groups are making their way through U.S. courts. One of the plaintiffs is Egyptian-born Yasser Ibrahim, who was picked up for a visa violation and spent 8 weeks in the Brooklyn Detention Center. He claims he was abusively strip-searched, physically abused, and denied medical care. Yet, many of the lawsuits have been dismissed because detainees were deported from the U.S. Upset with the surge of imports of Chinese-made clothing, the Bush administration in mid-May imposed quotas on imports of shirts, pants, and underwear. Since global garment restrictions expired on January the 1st, clothing imports into the U.S. of cotton trousers spiked by 1,500% and other clothing items have risen by similar levels. As a result, 16,000 American textile workers have lost their jobs and 18 factories have closed. According to The Nation magazine, a bipartisan group of U.S. senators is now moving to impose stiffer sanctions against China. Led by New York Senator Chuck Schumer, the group is pushing a bill to impose 27.5% tariff on Chinese imports to be preceded by a six-month bargaining period. Other orthodox free traders like Fred Bergsten, head of the Institute of International Economics, is worried about the bulging U.S. trade deficit, now topping $600 billion, equal to 7% of the U.S. economy. Some Wall Street traders are also concerned that the trade deficit has not declined despite the falling dollar. The push for import restrictions could be a golden opportunity for critics of globalization to make their case. The enormous trade deficit could trigger a rise in interest rates as global investors, specifically China, start pulling their money out of the U.S. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
On Tuesday, May 17th, Cuban exile Luis Posada Carriles was detained by Customs and Immigration Police near Miami and transported to the former Homestead Air Force Base in South Florida, reportedly flown there by the Department of Homeland Security. 77-year-old Posada, a violent anti-Castro militant seeking asylum, entered the United States illegally through Mexico in March of this year, making his way to Miami. The Bush administration claimed ignorance of his whereabouts, despite a formal asylum petition submitted by Posada. Venezuela has requested his extradition, which now forces the Bush administration to contend with the issue. The Venezuelan government charges that Luis Posada Carriles, along with Orlando Bosch, masterminded the bombing of Cubana Airlines Flight 455, which exploded shortly after takeoff from Barbados on October 6, 1976, killing 73 people. Posada Carriles, who has only been charged with entering the United States illegally, was planning to leave the U.S. just prior to his arrest. While in Havana, more than a million Cubans marched past and protested at the U.S. interest section there, demanding Posada's arrest by the U.S. government. Jane Franklin is the author of Cuba and the United States, A Chronological History. She spoke with your reporter, Denise Manzari, about Luis Posada's terrorist activities and the double standard the Bush administration exhibits in its fight against terrorism.
He was active for the administration of the dictatorship of General Fulgencio Batista before 1959. He was a sales representative for Firestone in Havana. He was in the CIA or working with the CIA by 1960 in Havana and was found out. He left Cuba in February 61, just prior to the Bay of Pigs invasion, and was training for the Bay of Pigs invasion, but his particular unit never got to the island. So then he engaged with Alpha 66 primarily, in raids against Cuba for years, many raids. The failure of the 1961 invasion led to another plan to invade, Operation Mongoose, and Posada was active all through those years. Now, as revealed later in FBI and CIA documents, Koru was soon involved in more than 50 bombings and quite likely political assassinations. And one of the people that was working closely with Koru was Cuban exile Luis Posada, who planted a bomb at the Costa Rica-Cuba Cultural Center in San Jose, Costa Rica, on July 1st of 1976. Now, this was a few months before the plane was flown out of the air. Posada had by then been working with the CIA since at least 1959. Now, there were many bombings that year, and of course, that culminated in the 1976, October 6th, bombing of the Cubana jetliner, civilian jetliner, killing all 73 people aboard, including Cuba's fencing team, a young group of Cubans, and a number of people from Guyana and North Korea. Posada had trained at Fort Benning, which was a notorious training spot. When he was exposed, when that whole thing was exposed, if you remember, the plane was shot down, and Eugene Hasenfus identified Felix Rodriguez and Luis Posada and so on, and it led to the Iran-Contra hearings, misnamed Iran-Contra hearings, in which Felix Rodriguez testified that he had brought Luis Posada to El Salvador and so on, and was praised for that by congressional members who should have known better already. After that was all exposed, Luis Posada drifted around Central America doing one terrorist action after another. For instance, he was thrown out of Honduras at one point for allegedly setting off 41 bombs in one year. That's almost a bomb a week. He went to El Salvador again, and in 1997, he engineered, masterminded, and paid for, with, of course, money from the mafia group in Miami, a bombing campaign in Cuban hotels aimed at the Cuban tourist industry. There were about 11 bombings or 12, and an Italian, Fabio Di Selmo, was killed by a flying piece of shrapnel in the Copacabana Hotel. Cuban intelligence arrested the people who had set the bombs. It turned out they were Salvadorans, paid $1,000 per bomb by Luis Posada, who was in El Salvador. And he admitted all of that to the New York Times in those articles in 1998, bragged about them. He sent more people, Guatemalans this time, with bombs to Havana in 1998. This kind of thing was going on constantly. He was also trying to fascinate people. Whenever Fidel Castro went to any foreign capital for any meeting, Posada and his cohorts would try to kill Fidel Castro. The other possibility that Cuba has brought up is giving him over to an international tribunal for trial. But, of course, Venezuela is really demanding that the extradition treaty that they have with the United States, and they've had it since 1922, be recognized. And this is a state-to-state relationship that the United States should honor. Posada right now is being held in El Paso, Texas. He has a hearing coming up on June 13th. Venezuela is demanding, actually, his extradition within 60 days, or Venezuela says if it's not done within 60 days, they will reevaluate their relationship with the United States and perhaps break diplomatic relations. So it's a serious situation for the United States since Venezuela provides a lot of oil to this country.
That was Jane Franklin, author of Cuba and the United States, A Chronological History, published by Ocean Press. For more information on the Posada case, visit the website www.disinfo.com or www.bardakreports.com. The U.S. Air Force announced on May 18th their intention to secure presidential authorization to develop and deploy defensive and offensive weapons in outer space. The announcement reveals a space weapons program that has already spent billions of dollars on developing space weapons, but largely hidden from public view. President Bush is expected to soon issue a directive that will give the Air Force the authority they seek to pursue a weapons program similar to Ronald Reagan's Star Wars initiative, first proposed during the 1980s. Critics point out that the Pentagon's plan to deploy hunter-killer satellites, platforms in space from which to attack Earth targets using laser beams, radio waves, and spaceships, may not be technologically feasible or cost-effective. They also fear that an American move to militarily dominate space would likely trigger a new global arms race in space. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bruce Gagnon, coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Gagnon, who actively opposed the weaponization of space for more than a decade, discusses the reasons why he believes a U.S. space weapons program could make the nation less secure while needlessly spending hundreds of billions of dollars.
Well, it's really no surprise. For years, the Pentagon Space Command has been talking about how they're going to deny other countries access to space and that the United States is going to be the master of space. And so really, Bush is essentially just creating military doctrine. He's now issuing a presidential directive to put in motion this program. The difference, I think, at this point is that in the intervening years, the Space Command, the Pentagon, have come closer to developing the actual technologies to make anti-satellite weapons possible. The idea is that the United States would send up weapons to destroy other countries' satellites, giving the United States complete control and domination of space. And so that's really what it's about.
Bruce, what exactly are the weapons they're talking about, and what are the likely repercussions from allies as well as perceived enemies in reaction to a U.S. weaponization of space?
The Pentagon is working on anti-satellite weapons. They call them kinetic energy anti-satellite weapons, or ASATs. And the job of these weapons would be to go up and literally smash in to another country's satellite, destroying it. They're also working on anti-satellite weapons that would essentially go up and kind of envelope another satellite. One of the more dangerous ones that is under development is what they're calling the Global Strike military space plane. So it would sort of be a smaller version of the shuttle, if you can imagine, and it would have the capability to come in and out of space on its own. So this is a system that I think will be very, very provocative, because as a military space plane is flying around and having the ability to go from one part of the planet to the other in just a few moments, Russia or China would be tracking it on its radar, not knowing if it's now going to launch an attack on them at any moment, and they will have to keep their nuclear weapons on hair trigger alert. There's also a system called Rods from God, as it's called at the Pentagon, where they would send these tungsten or titanium or uranium rods firing from space at speeds of over 7,000 miles an hour with the force of a small nuclear weapon coming down and hitting targets in a particular country. So all kinds of technologies being developed for war from, in, and through space. And, of course, China, who today has 20 nuclear missiles capable of hitting the continental United States, while the United States has over 7,000 nuclear weapons of our own, China is saying, hey, if you develop these technologies, it's going to really negate our 20 nuclear missiles, our retaliatory capability. And they say, you will force us to build more nuclear weapons. And, of course, Russia is saying the same thing. You'll force us to build more nuclear weapons. And so this really essentially will create a new arms race, and it will force China and Russia to respond as well by developing their own space technologies to try to attack American satellites. And the only people that would stand to benefit from this would be the aerospace corporations, the weapons corporations.
Bruce, are there any treaties or conventions that stand in the way of the United States weaponizing space?
There was the anti-ballistic missile treaty, the ABM treaty, that Bush walked away from soon after coming into office. It restricted the development of a lot of these systems. Today, there's only the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 that says there can be no weapons of mass destruction in space. The Pentagon, of course, says that all these weapon systems that I just outlined are not weapons of mass destruction. They say they're weapons of selective destruction and therefore fall outside of the Outer Space Treaty. And for that reason, Canada and Russia and China and other countries for many years now have been trying to bring the United States to the table to negotiate a new international updated ban on weapons in space, something that would cover, all the latest technologies. And it's the United States and Israel that are refusing to enter these negotiations because it's those two countries that are now leading the way in developing these new technologies for warfare in space. So without a treaty, it's going to be very, very difficult to block these new approaches. And most importantly, I think, they're going to be so expensive. And, we have a massive budget deficit in America right now. And so there's only one way to pay for this, and that's to further cut social spending, to go after Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and what's left of the welfare program after Bill Clinton got finished with it, and education and environmental programs. These are the programs, actually, that the lobbyists of the military-industrial complex are now targeting to transfer the money from those programs into these new space weapons technologies. So we're in for a hell of a fight now over all this stuff.
That was Bruce Gagnon, coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Call the network at area code 207-729-0517 or visit their website at www.spaceforpeace.org. Amid rising violence in his country, Afghan President Hamid Karzai visited Washington May 23rd and expressed his desire for more autonomy for his government, largely under U.S. control since the American invasion in 2001. Mr. Karzai also denounced the mistreatment of prisoners detained by the U.S. military and asked for the return of all Afghan prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba back to Afghanistan. But he got little satisfaction from President Bush, who only addressed the issue vaguely. At least two Afghan men have died in U.S. custody at the American Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. Sonali Kolhotkar is co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission, based in Los Angeles, who last visited Afghanistan in February. Kolhotkar, a host at LA's KPFK radio, asserts that the majority of Afghans elected Hamid Karzai president last year based largely on his vow not to compromise with the warlords who oppose the Taliban, but who have a history of violent and misogynist behavior. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Sonali Kolhotkar, who explains why many Afghans are upset with Karzai's recent actions that they believe betray his campaign promises. She also provides an update on the status of Afghanistan's women.
He claimed that he was co-opting the warlords and neutralizing them, but in fact he was legitimizing them with government positions, and a lot of Afghans are very, very upset about this. Ordinary Afghans' voices are never heard. You know, we hear the fundamentalists and what they're doing. We hear what the U.S. And their puppets are saying, but we rarely get to hear ordinary Afghan voices. And people are upset about what Karzai has done. Now, Karzai is sort of trying to maintain a veneer of independence. He made a comment here while he was in the United States saying the Afghans are nobody's puppets, and I sort of suspect he was referring to himself because he knows that he is seen as a U.S. puppet. And but you can see his actions speak louder than words. For example, right after there were rumblings from the United States that it would make its military bases permanent in Afghanistan, and after the U.S. had pumped $83 million into upgrading its military bases, sort of an indication that they were going to be made permanent, Karzai sort of magically turned around and said he would welcome the United States or invite the United States to stay in Afghanistan for the long term. So essentially rolling out the red carpet and enabling the United States government to say, look, the Afghan people want us in their country. But he is there to serve U.S. interests while trying to stabilize the country.
The Bush administration touts its commitment to women's equality in Afghanistan, with Laura Bush recently traveling there to highlight that commitment. How does the situation of women in Afghanistan look to you?
Women have been used to justify a war of liberation in Afghanistan, but this is not the first time. They've been used many times before, whether it was by the U.S.-backed fundamentalists, by the Taliban themselves, who said they were saving women from the fundamentalists who came before them. The Russians said the Soviets said that they were saving women from fundamentalists, and then the U.S. came and said that they were saving women from the Taliban. So women have been used and abused many, many times over the past few decades to justify politics and war, etc. What I found when I was in Afghanistan recently was that certainly women have regained some very basic rights, which is they have the right to education, they have the right to health care, they have the right to employment. Now, that doesn't actually mean that they have any opportunities. We hear President Bush use the number 5 million girls are now going to school again. And it's true that there are many girls who are able to go to school, but what's wrong with that fact is that most of these schools are in cities like Kabul. Kabul gets the bulk of the attention. It's the capital of Afghanistan, but it only houses 20% of the residents of Afghanistan. In the countryside, there are no schools, or if there are schools that exist, they have a very limited curriculum, only limited to Islamic studies, like under the Taliban. And so it's very, very problematic. Women don't have doctors in Afghanistan that are skilled, and they just don't have enough doctors. Before the Taliban, maternal mortality was among the highest in the world in Afghanistan. Today, maternal mortality is still at the same rate in Afghanistan. In the Badakhshan province in Afghanistan, the highest ever recorded rates of maternal mortality have been found, with one in every 15 births leading to the death of a mother. United Nations just released about a month or two ago its development report on Afghanistan. Every year the UN does the UNDP ranking, where it ranks countries according to human development. And that's basically based on a bunch bunch of socioeconomic factors. Afghanistan had never been listed because they just never had enough facts. And this year, for the first time, after establishing an office in Afghanistan, the UNDP was able to rank Afghanistan. It ranked it 173 out of 178 countries worldwide. And in that report, it described maternal mortality and this fact that I just gave you of Badakhshan province exhibiting the highest maternal mortality ever recorded in the world. It also called the education system in Afghanistan the, quote, the worst education system in the world. And this is despite Bush's assurance that women and girls now have access to education. Now, it's true that according to the Constitution, women have the rights, but having the right to do something does not actually mean that one is able to exercise those rights. There's a big difference between having the right and being able to exercise it. A few incidents that took place recently, I think, really highlight how inhospitable the country still is to women and women's freedoms. There was a woman who was stoned to death for supposedly for adultery in one of the villages recently. There were three women aid workers, Afghan women aid workers, who were working with foreign non-governmental organizations who were literally lynched. They were raped and hung and displayed with a sign that said, this is a warning to women, Afghan women, about working with NGOs. Most recently, a TV newscaster was shot, and this happened after she was fired from her job as a TV newscaster. She was fired because conservative mullahs didn't want to see a woman on TV. So all of these incidents have happened in the span of just a couple of months, highlighting how dangerous it is for Afghan women still in Afghanistan to exercise their social political rights. Two things people can do. They can ask the media to cover Afghanistan, and I would really urge them to consider making financial donations towards humanitarian social political projects led by Afghan women.
That was Sonali Kohatkar of the Afghan Women's Mission. Contact the group by calling area code 626-676-7884 or visit their website at www.afghanwomensmission.org. Get more information on the status of women in Afghanistan by visiting the website of the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan at www.rawa.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.